Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with Heber City Mayor Colleen Potter. We'll be talking about the Sorensen annexation that the City Council will be voting on next Tuesday. Then Park City Council Member Nax Dorlny in with a recap of last night's meeting. Park City Fire District Battalion Chief Mike Owens will be talking about the Blue Ribbon Commission, as well as the upcoming wildfire season. And again, with those gusty winds expected Sunday and Monday and Tuesday, please be very careful with any outdoor fire. It's 8:08 now, and on the phone with us from Mountain Trails Foundation, Charlie Sturgis. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you this morning?
Doing great, thanks.
Good. It is a little gloomy, but, you know, at the moment, as I'm getting ready to run out for a quick ride, I think we're at least rideable for the time being. So the dirt and so forth seem pretty good. A couple just fun things. I guess the good news is we have had some really dry weather. We don't have to talk about mud a lot, but now it would be nice to get a little bit of rain in here for a day or so. So let's see what happens. We are going to be completing a new kind of, I guess, an extension of a trail between the Gate to Nowhere and the King Bench. So you will see that kind of finish up today. So that should be ready for some weekend riding. And if you haven't enjoyed the new reroutes over there by the Cove, Mats and Round Valley Express, please get out there and check them out. They packed in really well, and those are in great shape to go. You know, quite honestly, let me just remind people that we are doing our races virtually this year. We hope you can get behind the fun of that. And then, you know, it is kind of a fundraiser that is going to be marginal probably for us this year. Like so many other organizations, we are going to be marginal on some of our fundraising activities. And it looks like a good weekend, so get out there and have a ball.
Okay, Charlie, you too. Thanks.
Yeah, bye-bye.
KPCW News Time now, 8:10.
Tired of cooking during this stressful time? Let KPCW help with suggestions on who is open to serve you with curbside delivery, takeout, and drive-through options. Plus, it's a great way to help your local business. Go to kpcw.org and click on Support Local Restaurants, covering Park City, Heber City, and all of Summit and Wasatch Counties. Did we miss your business? Then email us at localbusiness@kpcw.org to be added to our list. Stay safe, stay healthy, and keep listening like a local.
It's 8:10 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Taking a look at some local news now. When the rest of Utah eases into a yellow or low risk level for COVID-19 at midnight tonight, Summit and Wasatch counties will remain at an orange or moderate risk level. Health officials say that's because of the high rate of the disease per capita in these counties. Last night, the Summit County Council passed a new health order, which clarified what the orange level means. The purpose of this new 16-page order is to ease some of the protocols that businesses have to follow to help prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Summit County Deputy Health Director Phil Bondurant said that the new order removes the business-specific protocols for the majority of the business sectors in Summit County that were put into place on May 1st when all businesses were allowed to reopen. There are still restrictions for restaurants and food services, lodging, indoor recreation and arts, entertainment venues, and special events. Those restrictions are largely the same as they have been since May 1st. For restaurants, no more than 6 people can be at a table unless they are members of the same family. Tables must be spaced 6 feet apart. For indoor gyms, there can be no more than 1 person per 100 square feet and no more than 20 people on each floor, and that includes the staff. For all businesses, employees who interact with the public must wear a face mask, and that mask must cover both the nose and mouth. Public and private gatherings in Summit County are still limited to 20 people or less, while in the rest of the state, those gatherings can be up to 50 people. Bondurant said one specific concern for the county is that as businesses reopen, employees from other hotspots like Salt Lake City and Utah County could be a new source of exposure of COVID-19 here in Summit County. The new order is in effect for 7 days, at which point the council will look at a number of data points, including the infection rate of COVID-19, as the number of people in the hospital as because of the disease, and possibly revise this order. KPCW has all 16 pages of the new order up on our website, kpcw.org. Park City Municipal is holding a second distribution of personal protective equipment known as PPE today from 1 to 5 p.m. at Miners Hospital there in City Park. Businesses can access PPE supplies through the cooperative program being offered by Summit County, Park City, and the Park City Chamber Bureau. Today's distribution will run until material supplies run out. Summit County health orders must be followed when business representatives come to pick up the supplies. Business licenses are required to provide proof of a Summit County or Park City business license. A photo of your business license is sufficient. This is a cash-free transaction, so businesses will be invoiced later. The city asks that businesses take only what they'll need for a month. Supplies are available on a first-come, first-served basis. Businesses and organizations are encouraged to establish long-term supply chains. The Chamber is offering a number of sanitation products for sale at deeply discounted rates. Hand sanitizer is available in gallon containers. Please bring your own containers if a smaller amount is preferred. Vinyl gloves in various sizes are available in 100 pairs per pack with a maximum of 4 packs. Disposable masks can be purchased in a quantity of 50 per pack. Medical providers looking for PPE should contact eoc@summitcounty.org. N95 masks are being prioritized for medical providers. Additional PPE is estimated to ship May 20th. Thermometers are available, but they will be prioritized for businesses which require them. For any questions, contact Jenny Dearson at jenny.dearson, D-I-E-R-S-E-N, at parkcity.org. Again, that's happening this afternoon from 1 to 5 p.m. at Miners Hospital, located in City Park. Utah's primary election day is coming up June 30th with a number of tweaks and changes. In particular, KPCW's Rick Bruff reports there will be no in-person voting. Ballots must be mailed or dropped off.
Summit County Clerk Kent Jones said the primary voting is almost entirely concerned with contests within the Republican or Democratic parties. The only exception is a nonpartisan primary race for the South Summit School Board. The first significant date coming up is June 19th. That's the deadline to register with a party for the first time, update your registration, or change it. Jones said to vote in the GOP primary, you must be registered as a Republican. For the Democratic primary, an unaffiliated voter can request a Democratic ballot.
Now, where we just got through with the presidential primary in March, a lot of the unaffiliated people requested a Democrat ballot for both elections. So if you got a ballot in the mail for the March presidential primary, then that's a sure sign that your address is correct. If you requested a Democrat ballot then for both elections, you don't have to request it again. But if you haven't requested a Democrat ballot, you would need to.
The June 30th election will be done entirely with ballots that will be mailed to voters. The only exception is that county clerks will accommodate disabled voters if necessary. Jones said that just for this year, the Utah legislature changed the mailing requirements.
The legislature allowed for this election only. They can have a postmark on election day. Previously, it had always been it had to be postmarked at least the day before. Now it can be any time up to and including election day postmark. Or you can put in drop boxes, and the drop boxes are going to be in the same locations that they've been in the past. Fauville, Marsac, Fresh Market, Jeremy, the Market at Park City, Camas, the Sheldon Richens Building, and in our clerk's office.
Mail-in voting has increased voter participation, and Jones said he has no concerns about voter fraud.
You know, each election you'll find, when we go through and verify signatures, you'll find that either, you know, a husband and wife mixed up their envelope and maybe signed the wrong envelope. We'll send cure letters to those people and say, hey, this signature didn't match. Get your spouse sign this letter, or maybe they'll sign in place of one of their children if they're away at school or something like that. We'll catch those kind of things. But as far as fraud, we don't see that.
Summit County Clerk Kent Jones, he said one other change mandated by legislators is that there will be no ballot results disclosed before 10 p.m. on the 30th. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
46 degrees. Again, looking for mostly cloudy skies today with a high of 57. Right now, it's 819. Well, as we have reported, the Heber City Council will be annexing what has been known as the Sorensen property. On the phone with an update of that and some other Heber City issues, I have Mayor Colleen Potter. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So we call this the Sorensen annexation, but is it for all intents and purposes, also known as the Jordanelle Ridge Master Plan?
Yeah, well, it's the Upper Jordanelle Master Plan community is what we have on the development agreement. So, yes.
Okay. So we're talking about 5,700 units. This is to the north of Heber City. It was originally approved by the Wasatch County Council. So, I mean, this basically comes whether or not the city annexes the property or not. Why do you think that the council should agree to annex the property?
Well, there are a couple reasons, and one of them is that urban development belongs in cities. Cities are designed for urban development. We have better processes, and then people have to pay municipal taxes for the services they receive. If they are in an unincorporated part of the county, we all pay for their services as county taxpayers, and I feel like they should be paying municipal services if they're in urban densities. The other one is I think it's going to be a better development in the city. We've done a huge effort of planning, and they're going to benefit from that. We have, you know, better sign ordinances, dark sky ordinances, and I think it'll be a better development as part of Heber City.
And the property, just to locate, is along the east side of US 40. It runs towards the Jordanelle Dam and State Route 32 to the north. So you say that it's better for Heber City. What did the developers get by coming into the city?
Well, I think it helps them be more successful. And like I said, we have this big Envision Heber 2050 plan where we've put a lot of effort into long-term planning, our standards. We have open space requirements. There's going to be village centers. This will be more clustered development than it would have been under the county. They had their traditional zoning, and we've changed ours. So there's cluster development. We've changed our street standards to be narrower. I think it's going to feel less impactful because of this, and I think it'll make it more successful for the developer as well.
Hmm. And was there any reduced density as a result of it coming into the city?
No, there was not reduced density.
Hmm. And then
but there was not increased density either.
The updated general plan, does that change anything how this property will be developed?
Yes, like I said, the main thing is that we have created these clusters. So there are three main village centers. So it brings the density and the action and sort of, you know, to create sort of a synergy where there will be more support for some retail and commercial because the development will be more clustered. So of the 8,000 acres, over 5,000 will be open space.
All right. And I guess that's what I'm asking then. The general plan requires that this development be clustered and requires village centers. That's what part of the general plan does.
Yes, uh-huh.
All right. And I think at just more than 8,000 acres, it basically doubles the size of Heber City and more than doubles the population. Will it also double the tax base?
Well, the expected time to take for it to develop is about 40 years. So, yes, the anticipation is that it will bring in at least that much, at least double.
Yeah.
Because the values, I mean, depending on whether it ends up being primary residences or second homes, and that's not totally, you know, we can't predict that necessarily because of the way the market changes.
Hmm. And based on what's being proposed, does it feel like more like a primary home neighborhoods? I mean, we've got school sites and parks and everything, you know, and grocery stores and...
Yes, all of those things. I think it will be. I think it'll be not like affordable, like 10% of it will be affordable housing, deed restricted, that whole thing. But I think it will be the in between. It won't be the really extreme high end, but it'll be sort of achievable for working families.
So how much commercial is there? I mean, in terms of that, because we often hear that residential housing does not pay its own way. It costs a lot more to service homes than it does businesses.
You know, I always have a hard time with that conversation because residential pays whatever we assess for taxes. And so we don't assess the full amount that it costs because we get sales tax revenue from the commercial that comes with it. So each of these village centers have retail and commercial anticipated. We do have areas that are zoned commercial and don't have commercial because we have to have a willing business to come in there, and it's expensive up here right now. So, but the thought is, with the number of rooftops that have been approved, it will drive the commercial, and that will subsidize the tax base to make it so that it helps pay for the services of those homes.
So how much commercial does the master plan allow for?
How much acreage?
Yeah, or square footage, I guess, is what I'm asking for, yeah.
You know what? I don't have that number right here. I have a 50-page document, and I can't give you the number. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I guess I'm... Could we have another Smith's out there, you know, at 50,000 square feet?
I don't know. The one village center on the north end is the one that's anticipated to have hotels and a lot of retail. It's the Lakeside Village Center, and there is anticipation of having a lot of retail and commercial at that end. But some of this stuff is still processing, but there's definitely been a lot of, you know, requirement and space awarded to them for that. So I think there will be quite a bit of, not as much on the one up on the top, up over the top, because that will mainly serve the people that live there. But the one on the north end and the UVU center, it appears that there will be a lot of people coming to those from other areas as well. So I think we'll see more retail and commercial in those two village centers.
Yeah. And I guess the question is, it comes down to, I mean, do we have, you know, all 10,000 plus people needing to drive into town to buy gas and groceries, but it sounds like they would be able to get there. Without having
to. Yeah, and that's the anticipation, is so that it's more mixed use, it's more accessible, it's less demand on the roads because people aren't having to all drive to Smith and Heber City. There will be places anticipated to meet all the needs on the north end of town.
And you mentioned 10% affordable housing deed restricted is required as part of the general plan. Does this get interspersed throughout the project, or is it all in one place and it's like, oh, that's where the low-income housing is?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's another requirement in the Master Development Agreement, is that they do not have it all in one area. It has to be spread throughout the different village centers, so it's not all one center of affordable housing.
All right. So 10% of 5,700 units. I mean, we're talking about, you know, 550 units then, huh?
Correct. Yes. A lot.
Single family? Are we talking duplexes, multiplexes, apartments? Do we know yet?
It'll be a mixture of all of them.
And as you mentioned, also lots of open space, some 5,000 acres. Who maintains that open space? Do you need to get a land trust involved?
Right now, it's anticipated that the open space will be dedicated to the city, and so then the city will maintain the open space. And the council is in conversations about how that will be funded and how that'll all work out still. And most of the trail system that Sorensen has already built will stay, except with some of it being relocated and then added to. So we'll see a lot of what the trails are that people love and are already using will be maintained and stay the way they are.
That's that Coyote Canyon trail system?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Coyote, yeah.
So one issue that was raised via public comment is whether it's wise for the city to lock in the developers to current zoning laws for the next 40 years. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it depends on, so when it's a large MDA like that, it's very common to let them lock in so they have predictability, because these are investors who want to know what they're getting. And if we say, well, we might change this on you next year, we're going to get a higher quality development if they have some predictability and they're not thinking, wow, we better withhold some cash because the city might change our road standards or they might require more of us. So if they know what's happening, we believe the quality of the development will be higher. One example, right, and we also have in the development that if the developer agrees with the city, they will make changes as time moves on. They want to have the best development possible, as do we. currently they are agreeing to some changes we haven't even adopted yet on street standards, that the council is looking to narrow some of our street requirements for less concrete and more, you know, wider park strips. They're agreeing to those things even though we haven't adopted them yet. So we believe that it will work out for the best of the development that way.
All right. And then one item the council was working on was a second access road to the development through the Coyote Canyon. How's that going?
So what's going to happen is it will be determined in the future and it will be done through the capital facilities plan. So it can be a part of it. We can collect impact fees, but we will also hear what the public input is. There's a lot of people up in that area that don't want to have all the traffic coming down through Coyote. It's going to change the way the north area of town looks and feels with that kind of traffic and movement. Their traffic study showed it wasn't needed, that the traffic could be handled on the other roads, but we want to preserve the option. So it will be determined in the future if it's built out or if it's maintained as a public access trail.
All right. So any outstanding issues that you know of for the council?
I think there are a couple last issues that they're talking about before Tuesday, and it is to determine what level of services will be found. There's several different kinds of parks in this master development agreement, neighborhood parks and village centers and public parks, and we've got them to build three trailheads as well, bigger, larger areas. And the council is just wanting to pin down, you know, what's required there, how many parking spaces, how big are these parks going to be. So there are some requirements in the MDA currently that have been agreed to, but I think the council is looking to bump it up a little bit before Tuesday, and we'll see what that looks like on Tuesday night.
Okay. Anything else you're working on that you wanted to mention?
Oh, wow. We're just working on, you know, we, like Summit County, are still in orange, and so we're just still navigating that. It's sucking a lot of air out of the room for everybody. We are seeing some of our businesses open up again and people feeling a little more hopeful, but I think it's still hard for people. It's still hard for people economically. We have some, you know, a lot of the lower income people live in Heber that provide services to the areas all around, including Park City and Midway. And so we're seeing people struggling financially, but I think there's been a lot of good, kind people helping. And I think we're seeing progress. I'm hoping we can get to yellow sooner while maintaining the low numbers of coronavirus that we're seeing in our county.
All right. Well, Colleen Potter, I appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. Have a great day.
That's the mayor of Heber City, Colleen Potter. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Stay tuned. We'll be checking in with Park City Council member Max Doyleney. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Council met yesterday with the bulk of their discussion centered on the budget. Park City Council member Max Doyleney joins me on the phone this morning with details. Good morning, Max.
Good morning.
So the bulk of the discussion, again, drilling down into the budget for next fiscal year, the deadline, I believe, for public input has changed. Have you moved it up or have you moved it back?
For public input on the budget?
Yeah, I'd heard from June 25th to June 18th. And I guess I'm curious why you would give people less time than more time to do that.
Well, I'm showing June 25th.
Okay, so you moved it back.
Hold a public hearing and adopt a final fiscal year 2021 budget.
Okay, so people have until the 25th to say something about it before you vote on it.
Yeah.
All right. City Council also asked that another $250,000 be earmarked, even set aside. And this is for the a contribution to the Park City Community Foundation?
No. This is more like a savings account. We just, with everything being so up in the air, really there aren't a lot of questions that we can answer clearly. But we know that when we have the opportunity to provide some resources to the most vulnerable people in the area, it was nice to be able to do that. So we put $150,000 into four different organizations earlier this year, and that was in response to need. And knowing that this is going to be a long haul, we decided that we would bump up our savings account and then find where that need is later. But we would rather have the money, considering the budget's going to be so tight. We'd rather earmark that money now so that we know we have something to provide to the community when that need arises.
Okay. So where does that money, the $250,000, come from?
Well, that's a good question. this is my first time around on this budgeting process, finding every nook and cranny to find that money is hard for me to really track. But Jed Briggs is doing a great job of figuring out where we can cut and where we can paste. So we put that in there last night, and then I think at our next council meeting, he's going to define where everything's coming from.
All right. So we've been told that the council is looking at an $8.5 million drop in tax revenues being projected for next fiscal year. How did staff go about then cutting that kind of operating expense? I mean, was it based on what they know about the budget, or was there specific direction from the council?
Well, so we obviously worked together, and what we tried to do was, what we did was we deferred, delayed, or canceled all capital projects and equipment purchases for the time being. We did an operational, an op expense reduction across all departments. We didn't want one department to get hit exceptionally hard one way or the other, so we put it out to everybody. Everybody needed to cut a little bit. So that was, those are sort of the initial things that we did. We're continuing to do those. We have more than 100, we have 100 fewer positions filled right now than we did last time this year. We're also going into summertime with between 50 and 75 positions that are vacant. And we also did a hiring freeze. We suspended recruitment for vacant full-time positions. So we basically looked at the whole thing and tried to trim around all of the edges. Anything we could, we did, and we're continuing to do that going forward.
Yeah.
We're going to look, 90 days from July 1st, we're going to get a better idea of what this is all going to look like. And so it's a new budgeting process for all of us. And Jed pointed out last night, Max, pointed out to me last night, hey, Max, this isn't how it normally goes.
So what were these 100 people doing last year this time? I mean, for us to not need them this year.
Well, a big chunk is transit, right? I mean, we had to cut a ton of our transit operators this year early. Luckily for us, we were going into mud season, and those things were starting. We were starting to peel back. We're trying to operate only on every municipal services on an as needed basis, sort of, so to speak. So it's all the way across. We had recreation has a smaller staff. Where are my notes here? ICE has a smaller staff. General administration and transit. Those are the four big categories where we have fewer employees this year than last.
Right, sure, because we're not doing swim lessons, so you've got a whole slew of swim instructors that aren't needed. Okay, that makes sense now.
Yeah, drivers, the ice arena hasn't been open, recreation facilities are just opening now, and that's on a smaller scale than it has in the past. A lot of our programs are shut down. And then, another big, huge chunk of this is there are 130 part-time officers, police officers that we keep on to help us with events and deal with all of our summer activities. None of them are coming back right now unless we have a major change in our event schedule.
Okay. Councilmember Tim Henney asked about the bucket of money, some $6 million collected through transient room taxes, which were tagged for tourism marketing. He wanted to understand how these funds will be managed through the crisis. Do we know that yet?
We don't know. We don't know. And he's right to try and look for any money we can look for and any other resources in the community to help when we get into trouble. But another point was made that the government, the state government, hasn't approved us to use those monies in different ways yet. Now they're going to readdress that again soon. The county and the city, along with the chamber, everybody sort of asked for some leniency in how those funds can be used, but we don't have clarity yet.
Does the council have a position on how that money should be managed or spent?
Well, again, if we had clarity on the future, I think we would be putting it out there, but we don't have clarity on the future. I don't think anybody does.
All right. And we mentioned transit, where we're just not there. And again, it would have been service decreased anyway during this time of year. But I did hear that we're talking about going to our summer service starting in early July. Is that still the case, or do we know yet?
I'm not sure that we know for sure, but I think that right now we're trying to move forward with, you know, anticipating that we're going to have a little bit of a bump in activity. And therefore, we're trying to plan for the best case scenario, which would be to have to need some more transit so that as businesses open, we can get employees to and from work. That's critical, right? We found this winter during the visioning process and during all of our conversations over the last few years, we realized that the transit system is critical to our most vulnerable population and our workforce. They use it in the mornings and evenings over by where you and I live. When I was going skiing early, trying to have breakfast before skiing this year, those buses are packed between 6 and 7, and it's all employees. So we need to make sure they can get to and from work.
Okay. And just curious, what are you hearing from your contacts and interactions? Do they feel that the city's doing what's needed to support business in this difficult time?
You know, that's a good question, Leslie. I think that the majority of our residents understand the situation that we're in. And our roundtables have been doing a good job of trying to communicate with the community. The business community is obviously frustrated. They're hurting economically. But every time we get somebody who's really, really, really frustrated with what's going on, we try to have a one-on-one or a two- or three-on-one conversation where we can let them know all the things that we're trying to do to help them out. I own two businesses in town. I'm hurting economically. Both of those businesses were hurt dramatically by COVID-19. So I come from that side of the fence on a lot of different issues. But the other day, my wife took a little bit of a crash on her mountain bike, and it really highlighted, she's okay, but it highlighted the fact that, you know, we need our medical care system to be working at its best level, because we all like to get out and do fun things. So if our public health isn't coming first, then I would start to have even more anxiety than I do over my economic situation, because if she couldn't get to the hospital because we were wide open and we had no beds for her, that would be really, really frustrating. And our behavior up till now has really put us in a situation where I was comfortable. If somebody gets hurt in my family, I'm comfortable going to the hospital right now. And those are real, real needs that we're going to have going into summer. So I commend Park City and Summit County on its behavior so far. And the economic situation is really, really difficult. But I think we're doing a pretty good job.
Council Member Becca Gerber mentioned that she's pleased that the city's trying to perpetuate a culture of mask wearing in public. We've received a couple of phone calls and emails from a few unhappy residents saying that there have been lots of gatherings exceeding that 20 people. Distancing wasn't being adhered to, and most people not wearing masks. I notice in the grocery stores, I see a lot of mask wearing, very few on the trails. What's the city's role, if at all, in cultivating this mask-wearing practice?
I think the city's role is the same as any leadership organization, which is trying to perpetuate the, you know, good behavior through proactive measures. We're handing out masks and PPE equipment to businesses. We're trying to make sure everybody has the resources to behave in the way that we're requesting they behave. But as you know, you can't force people to do things they don't want to do. They're gonna do whatever they want to do, which is their right. But boy, it really does help us if everybody can get on board. And I agree with Becca wholeheartedly. If you can wear your masks when you're in public, and if you can keep your 6 feet distance, we're gonna all do better. And I'm anxious to get back to normal. I'm as anxious as anybody. But I really feel it's important to lead by example and wear my mask when I'm in big groups. And Yeah, I mean, I think that's all we can really do is try and provide the resources for people to do the right thing.
Yeah, well, one of these phone calls was that he wanted the cops to be sent out to City Park. Is that the city's job, to break these groups up?
Well, I've seen some reports of those types of interactions across the country, and they don't breed a whole lot of trust between groups of people who are fighting about this stuff. So I'm not sure exactly what the police's role would be in that situation. I would hope that the community can get together and lead by example, but I would hesitate sending police officers in to regulate these kind of things just yet, because I think the vast majority of our community is doing a really good job. And let's not highlight those fringes. Let's highlight the parts that are doing the best.
On Tuesday, the Historic Park City Alliance they're taking a survey. They want to find out whether or not we should at least offer one day of no cars on Main Street. I think the proposal is from like 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Has the council taken a position on no cars on Main Street at all?
Council's not taking a position on that yet. We are leaning on our business leaders to give us direction. I think it's really important that the people who are on Main Street, they know their businesses. They know exactly what's going on up there. And for us to force something on them without their input in a heavy, heavy way, I think would be pretty misguided. I have seen the plans. I've looked at, you know, logistically, it's really hard to do a no cars Main Street all the time. The HPCA did put out a survey. They have a little video that they put out that explains some of the difficulties. And I think we really need to lean on those businesses. You also have to remember, over 80% of the income on Main Street is from tourist business. So, you know, the idea that Park City is going to go up and support Main Street at the level it needs to be supported, it would require all of us going up there and spending our entire bankroll almost every weekend. It's incredibly unlikely that we're going to be able to do that. I want to make it as attractive for us as possible. But the numbers that are coming out of Main Street in terms of how to survive, they're really, really startling.
Finally, I wanted to ask you quickly about Mayor Bierman mentioning a dust-up, as he put it, with the county this past week regarding zoning changes that the county's interested in making. The mayor said the county officials took offense to the city's input. Can you tell me what's going on here?
You know, at the end of the day, I think that what happens is you have two groups of leaders, and we've been working really well together on so many different issues. There was some concern about some zoning issues going on out there. And I think that the communication, you know, sometimes when you communicate in a particular way, there was a memo that got read one way and the intention was not for it to be taken offensively. But, you know, and that sparked some emotional conversation. But at the end of the day, I've spoken with a couple county counselors. You know, everybody's pragmatic. Everybody's trying to get to the same goal, which is to have us be, you know, built out in the way that benefits our residents the most, but also caters to those people who like to come here. And sometimes we have a little difference of opinion, but that's just part of the program.
Well, if it's in the county, what has the city got to say about it anyway?
Well, you know, I mean, we have a close relationship. That's sort of like... That's like saying that your neighbor's fence, you know, doesn't bother you. It's just right next to you, you know? So you got to work together with your neighbor to have a good-looking backyard. They can't just put up whatever they want without your input. They can, but, you know, you're probably going to let them know how it feels to have it up there. So, you know, we're working together on everything. And to think that we're just going to not work together on something that's right on our border, I think that's unreasonable. We've been working hard with them to keep Park City and the surrounding areas looking and feeling a particular way for a long time. And occasionally you're going to have a little bit of a dust up. That just happens.
Okay, Max, I need to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Okay, thanks, Leslie.
That's Park City Councilmember Max Doyle. Stay tuned. We'll be checking in with Park City Fire District Battalion Chief Mike Owens right after this. Well, last week, Park City Fire District Battalion Chief and Fire Marshal Mike Owens gave the Summit County Council an update on a Blue Ribbon Committee on Wildfire Management. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning to you.
Doing, Leslie?
I'm doing great. Thanks. Okay, so
great to talk to you again.
As I mentioned, you presented to the County Council May 6th about a Blue Ribbon Committee. Can you tell me what this committee is and who's on it?
I can. So, Leslie, I want to let you know I have on the phone with me firefighter paramedic Brant Lucas. He's one of our firefighters, and he has he's kind of taken the head on this Blue Ribbon Committee. So the purpose of this group was to get a group of homeowners together who had interest in wildland fire preparedness. We had two purposes on this committee. One was to get a little bit of feedback on a potential ordinance that would help us protect structures a little better. And also to really get the community involved in developing these things called CWPPs, or Community Wildfire Preparedness Plans. The biggest advantage that we've seen from this committee is that groups were able to get together that didn't have a lot of communication prior to this, and they've been able to work together to solve the same problem. So these guys aren't reinventing the wheel. They're really helping each other do these things.
So is this, is it about education, or is it about home protection or enforcement or what?
So it's really about the education and home protection aspect of things. The general idea was that we know we have we live in a beautiful place, and part of the things that makes that beautiful is the vegetation around us. And if we don't take care of that vegetation, then it overgrows and it becomes a huge fuel load. So what we did is the people who would come to this committee, we started out by teaching them, you know, exactly how a wildfire works. We started with the very basics, how the fire spreads even down to, you know, convection, conduction, and radiation, the actual science behind fire. And once they had that understanding, they were able to come up with plans on how they could protect their own communities.
All right. So is there a cost for doing this?
A cost to be part of the group? Absolutely not.
Well, what about preparing these CWPPs?
No, in fact, let me let Brant answer that question. He's the one who worked with the communities on developing those, so he would be best to answer that.
Okay, Brant, I don't know if you had heard, but I'd asked, is there a cost to prepare a CWPP, a Community Wildfire Preparedness Plan?
Good morning. Yes, I did hear, Leslie. So there's no cost at all. The state of Utah actually provides a really user-friendly template for the CWPP, and they, at the end, they actually do just get submitted through the state. We have a kind of a northeast area fire management officer that will kind of take those CWPPs and submit them, and we keep them on file with the Park City Fire District as well. And it's just a great plan to kind of identify hazards, kind of create a plan to start mitigating any of those hazards, and kind of a long-term goal and focus for that community. But there's absolutely no cost involved, so it's great.
Yeah, so does every neighborhood within the district have this plan prepared?
So I can't speak to that. We don't know 100%. We are aware of at least a dozen or so that do have these in place, or they've started to work on them. That's part of what I've been doing over the last year is starting to work with communities, because I think there was a lot of communities that were unaware of this and the benefits of it. So I would say in Park City, we've got really great HOAs and communities that are very much on board with creating something like this.
Yeah, so I know that you're out talking with homeowner associations. What if a neighborhood doesn't have an active homeowner association?
So the great thing about these plans is that it doesn't require any large formal group. These plans could be so small that they affect one property owner who has several acres, or they could be so large that they cover, you know, up to say 50 acres or 60 acres that's shared by several different neighborhoods. We have a lot of homeowners associations within our community that, you know, they cover one set of a couple of condo buildings, and that's all. And it wouldn't really be appropriate for them to have their own CWPP. But if they were to team up with their neighboring the neighboring condo owners, and they kind of draw a geographical line around a certain area, they can develop a CWPP for that area that benefits everyone.
All right. So if there is somebody interested and could form their own group, what do they need to do about developing their neighborhood CWPP?
You know, all they've got to do is give us a call. Brant, like he said, he's really been working with communities on developing these. There's a lot of work that they have to do themselves, but we will walk them through every step of the process.
Okay. Any neighborhoods in particular that you'd like to see get one done?
This committee, we've had such a positive response from it. The neighborhoods that we were really concerned about, they've pretty much all been involved with this committee from the beginning. And so our high-risk communities are really getting it done. It's really been great to see the community's response to this.
Okay. And like Summit Parks had it done for 6 years or so.
Go ahead.
Go ahead and you tell me about Summit Park then.
So Summit Park has had two things going for them. One of them is they've had their own CWPP in place, which has been great, and they've been active on it. And then the CWPP is not something that you can just put together and then file in a filing cabinet somewhere. The whole thing is a way to recognize hazards in your community and then develop a plan to get rid of those hazards. So Summit Park has been working on getting rid of some of their big hazards. And then as time goes on, they change their CWPP as the situation around them changes. On top of that, Summit Park has also done what's called the FireWise program, which is a nationally recognized program that helps people achieve some of these fire safety things that we're looking to achieve.
And then when I look at like Summit Park and the Colony, I mean, these are neighborhoods that have one way in and one way out. What do you do about that?
So there's some restrictions that we have just because of the nature of where we live. And there's not a lot that we can do. That's why it's so important that each individual homeowner really takes responsibility for their own property and gets rid of that. You know, if something does happen, what happens is slow to develop, and the consequences of it are much more reduced.
Okay. Well, it's a dry year with drought conditions already designated there in the southern part of the state. What are the projections here for northern Utah?
Brant actually talked with the state about that earlier this week, and we have a video that's about to go up online for that. Brant, go ahead and get that one.
Yeah, so the video actually went up on the Park City Fire District YouTube page yesterday, which kind of highlights the current predictions for this upcoming fire season. So we're actually sitting in relatively average conditions for our area, kind of in the Park City region. So right now we're kind of in that green up phase, but, it's going to obviously dry up our, 1 hour, 10 hour fuels, which is, your grasses, light brush, things like that. And then as we get into the later parts of the season, we are going to start to see, a little bit more drier fuel with the larger stuff. But it does kind of put us on alert, with seeing the fire just over the ridge the other day, of course. And those types of fuels, those smaller fuels, they're very susceptible to the high winds. So that's something we're going to need to keep an eye on. But as of right now, we're not seeing any major alarm for, a different kind of season. So okay. Relatively average at this point.
All right. I need to leave it there, Brant. Mike, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie. Thank you.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 8:59.
This is Mark with ESCO, Heating, AC, Plumbing, and Electrical, supporting KPCW. With this warm weather, we can perform air conditioning inspections and tune-ups. More info at 855-ESCO-NOW or escoutah.com. That's ESCO, ESCO.
Hearthen Hill, a KPCW and community supporter, has launched daily curbside takeout for lunch and dinner featuring an online menu plus family dinner meals such as whole roasted chicken, braised beef brisket, or chicken and steak fajitas, located on Center Drive in New Park at Campbell Junction. More information at 435-200-8840 or at hearth-hill.com.
Morning Edition and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is brought to you in part by Intermountain Park City Hospital, Intermountain Heber City Hospital, and the Red Ledges Community.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up, we've got Kirsten Lane in with some music. till noon. We'll have a noon report with Carolyn Murray, and then Randy Barton taking things over at 3 o'clock this afternoon. We've got 46 degrees right now, mostly cloudy skies, looking for a high today of about 57. We'll see some clearing, though, tonight. Mostly sunny tomorrow, 65 sunny and 77 forecast for Sunday and Monday. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City. It's 9 o'clock.